Ken Campbell,
The Seekers Podcast.
Walk about, snail speed, day long, last one, half one, belong everyone, something, bugger up, dead, finish yet, time.
Greetings, Seekers, and hilarious.
Welcome to Ken Campbell, The Seekers Podcast, hosted by me, David Bramwell, and Ken's daughter, Daisy Campbell.
For this unique series, we'll be plundering Ken's archive to offer the best recordings of his one-man shows in chronological order, or thereabouts, plus rare interviews, a live panel debate from the British Library, and a new dramatised performance of his anarchic kids' play, Skung Poomery, which we're rather excited about. For those unfamiliar with Campbell, you're in for a treat. Here's David with a two-minute crash course.
Ken Campbell was one of a kind. An unconventional performer, wordsmith, theatre director, comedian, trickster, and creative powerhouse with an impish grin and eyebrows like an abandoned allotment. He first came to prominence in the late 60s with an anarchic comedy ensemble, the Ken Campbell Roadshow, that included Sylvester McCoy and Bob Hoskins. In the 70s, he established the Science Fiction Theatre of Liverpool, directing, amongst others, the 8-hour Illuminatus trilogy and the 22-hour-long Guinness World Record-breaking The Warp. An impressive list of actors and artists worked under Campbell's legendarily zealous tutelage, including Jim Broadbent, Nina Conti, Bill Nighy, Toby Jones and Diane Morgan, to name but a few. Throughout the 90s and noughties, Campbell toured a string of award-winning one-man shows that plundered his life stories and adventures. A fantastical blend of fact and fiction, they were, for the most part, delivered on stage with little more than the odd prop. Subject matter veered wildly, from Cathar heretics and Pidgin English to time travel and the multiverse. One show, Hyphenator, began...
At the age of 64, I was sent out by my daughter with 500 quid and strict instructions to buy a computer. But then I discovered that for just a bit more money, I could get a parrot instead.
Actor Jeremy Stockwell there, who actually performed as Campbell in Terry Jonson's play Ken in 2017, will be utilising Jeremy's talents elsewhere in this series. Until recently, Campbell's body of work was largely confined to old cassettes and scratchy VHS recordings, slowly deteriorating. As such, please be aware that sound quality will vary throughout this series. For Campbell, the whole of life was one great caper, a mission to seek out the other. What was the other? Anything or anyone with the power to truly astound. And as we hope you'll discover, Campbell himself was a rare individual who possessed such power in spades. So Daisy, what do you have for us for our very first episode?
Yeah, this one is his very first one-man show, which he performed throughout the early 90s. This is The Recollections of a Furtive Nudist, Part 1. But just before that, here he is discussing how his one-man shows originally came about.
The genesis of the one-man shows. Well, the folk that I used to work with were either... millionaires, mad or dead, you know. It seemed time to be on my own now, you know, like, make a go of it. My problem was, I was not a great admirer of stand-up comedy as a genre. I mean, for sure, I'd occasionally see someone I thought was genius, but kind of as a world and as a thing, stand-up comedy, I mean, it seemed like such a narrow notion to me. So I wasn't attracted to it, but I couldn't think of really anything else until I saw Spalding Gray. I thought Spalding Gray was terrific. I mean, I thought, what is that? What would you call that he does? And I thought probably what you'd call it is sit-down tragedy. And so once I knew I was a sit-down tragedian, that was all fine. And it was a wonderful lady called Gillian Brown. Gillian Brown, must be 12 or more years ago, suddenly said, I've booked you in at a theatre. I said, what do you mean you booked me in? What do you mean? She said, well, someone or other's let them down at that little theatre. And I've said, you'll do it. I said, well, I'll do it. I mean, what are you talking about? She said, well, because I told them you will think of something. I said, well, you've got a nerve there. But anyway, so I went along and I saw the woman who ran the theatre and I offered to do a night of reminiscence. She said, well, that doesn't sound very good. Gee, I didn't want to be there either. She said, well, I tell you what, she said, look, why don't you do a tryout night? I'll bring some of my friends, you bring some of yours, and we'll see if it's any good. I thought I was doing them a favour. It's all, you know, getting out of hand. Anyway, so I did my night of reminiscence, and anyway, it went down all right. She said, oh, yeah, that'll be all right. And so it was booked into this little place to do 3 weeks. So I thought, well, here we go, kind of sit-down tragedian. This is going to be, you know, a bit of this, a bit of that thing. But then I went on Robert McKee's course. God, I thought he was stunning. You know, his account of what a story is and everything like that, I got riveting. There was a bit in his fine lecture where he said, and a story, says a story, is a bigger thing than life itself. So, wow, yes, I don't know if it's true or not, but it's quite a staggering thing to say. And there was a moment when he seemed to be, I mean, there was, I don't know, 500 people in the room that he was lecturing to. And at a moment, he seemed to be looking at me and he said, a story is a way bigger thing than reminiscence. I said, oh, well, then I'm thinking, I better go for what he calls a story, I think. So I converted my reminiscences into what seemed to be what he was saying a story is, you see. But in the doing of that, I discovered that if I was going to use a three-act structure, that I'd only got an act one and an act two. I didn't have an act three because it was reminiscences. I mean, because I had never lived act three. It was the thing that I've wisely not gone in for in life. So I had to invent things that hadn't happened now to make an act three story. I thought, gee, and I thought, God, it'd have to be something appalling and astounding. And then I'd heard that Robert McKee was running a How to Write Horror Movies course. So I'd better go on that, and maybe there'll be an act three in it. And so he, and he was terrific. He gave us the list of 28 things that most disgust and revolt people. I wrote it all down. I had the list. You know, came home with a list. Oh, that's terrific. I had been through the list of things that disgust people almost terminally. And I think I'll go for that one.
I had the fortune to be born in the war, early part of the war, in Ilford, suburb of London. As a matter of fact, I was conceived as a result of the war. Mr. and Mrs. Campbell had married, I think, about 1930, and they long wanted a child, but nothing was happening for them on that front. Until, whoosh, there was this low-flying doodle bug over Ilford, and it shot the relevant juices together, and I was formed. My earliest memories are of being underneath the dining room table, cuddled up with my mum. Sometimes my dad would join us, and it was covered with heavy metal, you see. And after the whizzing and the banging, then you just hear the sound of your own ears for a moment, and then the all clear sounds, and I'd be put into the toilet to perform, they say. And I think I may have given some of my best performances. Now, I used to literally perform for the creatures that I fancied I could see in the lino. It was basically an orange lino with abstract patternings in it, but I could divine the swamps and the jungles. Very particularly, there was the frog. I think it was a frog who used to draw from me these spectacular performances. Not only performances, I mean, plot lines too. I mean, wow. If I could only recall the final version of Flying Bomb Riders of Africa. Christmas with the Red Indians. Well, I'd probably have an Oscar. And I think also the frog, in some sense, was broadcasting into me, I think, knowledges that I had no right to possess. One more thing. There were two of us who did the performing. Now, the American author Philip K. Dick when in his novel Valis, he writes of an alter ego that he fancies he has, and he calls the guy Horse Lover Fat. And a few years ago, in the Philip K. Dick Society newsletter, they reminded us of how he came up with that name, Horse Lover Fat. He took his own first name, Philip, which in the Greek means admirer of the equestrian art, and Dick, which is the German for fat. You get it, Horse Lover Fat. If I do that with my name, Kenneth in the Celtic means the handsome one. And I split up the camp and bow, you get pretty boy tent ringer. Anyway, refer to my colleague of the Lost Toilet Dramas. We'll call him pretty boy tent ringer. When I was 8, the war now over, I was allowed to join the State Barking Side Saturday Morning Picture Club. And there was an interesting theory abroad at that time. That was, if you could pitch it just right, you could get an ice cream tub to slide down the projector's beam and hit the screen. But only the legendary John Spooner had this skill. Sadly, he'd been banned from the place by the time I joined. That wasn't for that, actually. What happened was he'd gone up into the circle one time with a jam jar full of foul concoction. And then he got pulling over the stool. And after the fine fun of the Saturday morning pictures, we always used to mob up the road to Fairlop Aerodrome. This was a now disused military airfield. It had underground tunnels, all swampy and stinky, and pillboxes. These were sort of anti-aircraft turrets. Anyway, one Saturday morning, the word goes round, there's a German in one of the pillboxes. Right, well, we knew our duty. And we went to rout him out. And we found him in the pillbox, a little weaselly guy. And he was protecting these pages he'd been writing on. Anyway, we chased him out of there. We chased him right off the airfield. We went back to the pillbox and examined these pages. And yeah, they were written in foreign. And so we peed on them. We had a group wee on them. And I was done quite decently. First of all, the 9 or so lads pissed on them, and then we sent the girls in after. But I don't know, there was something about that maybe troubled me. And the following Saturday, I returned alone to the pillbox, and it was clear the guy had not returned. And I was turning over these pages with a stick. The link between germs and Germans was well known. Anyway, in amongst his writings, I came across these drawings of his, really rather fine, and they were of Red Indians. There was Winnetou, the great warrior chief, Apanachka, young brave, but most lovingly detailed of all, Neshochi, the beautiful squaw princess. Now listen, I can confirm this with the little bit I've had to do with the bringing up of my daughter. Young kids produce sticky naturally. It's not necessarily that they've been playing in the jam or something. At times of excitement, they just exude the stuff. But I would say at that moment of the decision that I was going to take home with me the portrait of Neshochi, I exuded a record amount. Sadly, the portrait didn't survive the Dettol soaking I gave it. It occurred to me it was a twin health hazard to the family, that, you know. One, it was a German's, and two, it had been peed on. It disintegrated. Except in memory. In memory, I can recall it in all its detail. I was 25, and the phone rang. It was my father. He'd retired, and he and my stepmother had gone to live in Croyde in North Devon. My mother died when I was about 12. Anyway, he wanted to know whether I was ever going to go and visit them. And I said, well, yeah, of course I'm going to come and visit you. I said, in fact, I'll come now. And I just made an 8:35 van, and I sped off to North Devon. Anyway, as I was rounding the coastal bends about a mile out of Croyde, on the left, Saunton Sands. I mean, wow, this is a dunescape, you know, and it's craters, and mine's one of the moon. Anyway, I halted the van and I got out and had a little stroll on the dunes, but it was peculiarly hot. I say peculiarly because it was mid-Feb. And I returned to the van, and I hadn't thought to bring my bathing trunks, but I was taking clothes off. In fact, I stripped down to my underpants. And even back all those years ago, I used to wear that boxer style of underpant. It's due to an article I'd read. I'm now back on the dunes, at one with the dunes now. And of a sudden, I was addressed by a disembodied voice. And the voice said, "Why have you got your underpants on?" I said, "Look, for decency." And the voice said, "But there's nobody about." And I said, "Well, I mean, for sure we can't see anybody, but somebody might pop up at any moment." And the voice said, "No, you've got your pants on because you're scared to take them off." Hey, really scared, am I? I went home that time, I wasn't scared of being arrested, winding up in a police station. In fact, I rather felt that the story you might tell afterwards would make it worth it. What was holding me up was my dad, you see. I mean, I was very fond of that bloke. And the thought of being arrested for a stunt like this, just round the corner from where he just moved to. No, we can't indulge in that. Oh, no way. So what I did was, I removed my underpants literally circumspectly so that I was aware around the full 360 degrees that I was unobserved, and pants off, I buried them under a bush, and I took pains to memorise that bush. And then, I don't know if you've seen Kurosawa's great movie, The Seven Samurai. You have, you'll recall how they run in it. They don't run like joggers of today. That makes sense, because they're trying to protect their bollocks from the arrows. Anyway, that's actually how I was around the dunes. Like you go from clump to little butch like that for around here. And then suddenly there was the enemy overhead, the Air Sea Rescue Helicopter. I flattened myself down and I covered my crime with sand. And I thought, you know, those guys are going to suspect something if they see me in the middle of this desolate dune world, mid-Feb, making sand castles. They'll think I'm an escaped idiot needing rescue. So what I did was I posed as a boffin, working out some complicated algebraic conundrum in the sand, you know. All right, boys, unified field theory, if you just listen. Anyway, they passed overhead and on. And I was up again, and I was now at the end of the dunes. I was faced now with the great plain. No cover now, but a canyon. And I was crouched behind the last bush. And I felt terrific. I felt like Winnie too in his prime. And it wasn't a question of whether I was going to take on the challenge of the great plain, just a question of when. And the answer to when was when the juices were up. And the juices were up. Boom! And I was off over the plain. I have recall of flying over certain parts of that terrain, and then it came to me. I'll tell you who's going to be in those woods yonder. Nshochi! She'll be there! When I got there, there were signs of her, but she'd gone. Missed her. And it was getting a bit cold. It was beginning to drizzle slightly. And I thought, I think I'll go back now. And, but this time, as I was going over the great plain, I just simply strolled. It seemed to me that in some sense I now owned this territory. And that's when I was seen. There was a guy up aloft, and he was walking his dog, and he saw me, and I just turned fully towards him and waved. When I got back to the dunes, I thought, yeah, that was bright. You know, he's going to race round and make a citizen's arrest with his big dog, and that very low samuraiing now. Well-remembered bush, and in the van, and it was a very nice place my dad had. Now, that night, I had a dream, and in certain company, I refer to this as a vision. Anyway, in this dream, I understood everything. What we're doing here, the whole purpose of life, what we're meant to be getting on with, and I thought, God, this is important. So I woke myself up, and by the bedside was a book of crank speculation by a couple of Frenchmen that I was reading, Powell's and Bergier's Dawn of Magic. And I simply wrote into it, the book, all that seemed to me that would be necessary so I'd be able to clothe myself back into the vision. And the next morning I read what I'd written. Enormous swimming bath, vegetation and foliage in it. That was it. Oh, that's ridiculous. I mean, for sure, yeah, that was the location. Yeah. But I made no mention of the geezer who was down there. There was this all-important geezer down there. It was presumably from him that I'd received all this information. Yeah, but the more I tried to remember him, it was as if the act of actual recall was driving him further into the mists and fog. A couple of days later, a relative of my stepmother came to stay, and he was a distinguished old soldier. He'd been with Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin at Yalta. Evidently, on one night, he'd drunk Stalin under the table. Anyway, everyone else was in bed. It was just the two of us, myself and the old soldier. And he was telling me the most disturbing military secrets. And we got through a whole bottle of whiskey each. And I just like to give you, I think, you know, that last inch and a half of a bottle of whiskey could be damn near fatal. I mean, when it, especially if it's not you who's doing the talking. Anyway, I was able to get out of the room with some dignity. But when I got into the corridor, I thought it was medically advisable to crawl. And I crawled to the room I'd been allotted on the ground floor, and I fell backwards over the bed. And, oh, wow, and the ceiling was colliding mercilessly with the wall. Boom! Like that. But this was the panic, yeah, that this was going to be permanent now. I'd really done it this time. And then I heard from the voice. And the voice said, well, you know what to do. Now, at about 2:30 in the morning, looked out of the window. It did seem that everyone else was asleep. There was, certainly all the other lights were off. It was just the square of light that you'd see on the lawn coming from my window. So I took all my clothes off and I hopped out of the window. And I skirted the square of light and then I edged along the hedge. And I think I may have left my body for a few moments because I have the actual recall of the sight of my own bare arse as I open the gate and step out now, a naked man in a country road. I'm headed now towards Croyd Village. Extremely awake, very aware. At any sound that could have been the noise of an oncoming pedestrian, the first glint of a headlight over the brow of the hill, boom! I dive through the hedge and into the field behind. I flatten myself in the ditch. Uncaring of any wounds or scratches or stings that I was receiving. In fact, delighting in them. And then, at length, I'm in Croyd Village itself. Now, this is somewhat lamp-lit. And there are houses there and people who live on top of the shops. And it seemed to me that my best bet here was to make myself impossible of aspect. And so in a manner sort of inspired by the Ministry of Funny Walks and Professor Wolofsky and the Royal Ballet and everything, I eccentrically progressed myself through Croyd Village. My reasoning was this, that if somebody, you know, woke up and came to a window, looked up, they would assume they were still asleep. I now got myself to the last shop in Croyd, which is the only interesting shop there. It's the shop which sells the local and foreign shells. And I had the courage to linger there and choose my favourite exhibit, which was the shell frog. And then on from there and past the caravan site and then down onto the beach. And on the beach I heard voices. And I fancied these were of the bodied variety, so I gave them a wide berth, and then I got to the sea. And I had a sensible swim in the sea, and it was terrific how the salt licked into the wounds I'd received in the hedge and whatnot. And out of the sea, across the beach, up the cliff walk now, over the road, and hopped in through the window. And the voice said, okay now. But the only answer I could give was, I've never in my life felt better. But I never told this to a soul for many years. But then I was in the Café Fundus in Frankfurt. and I was drinking Himbeergeist in iced glasses with an artist called Hans. And I told Hans. And then Hans told me his story. Apparently, about 3 years previous, he'd been living in the south of Germany in the small town of P. Anyway, it occurred to me actually what he was doing, you know, in the manner of Edgar Allan Poe and Thomas Hardy. He was just giving me the initial letter of the place. Okay, what secrets are going to be unfolding here? Anyway, in P, actually. And evidently he had an artist's studio in P, and he'd set himself a courageous artistic challenge. He had stitched canvas together to the exact dimensions of the Bayeux tapestry. And not that he was going to knit you something, no, he was an oil painter, you know, science fictional, surreal, but in the manner of Mitch Davis's stuff here. And but here's how he was going about it. Every night at midnight, he'd set off from his studio and he would walk the streets of P. He'd walk them and he'd walk them for hours until it would come to him which part of the mighty canvas he was to attack that night. He would return to the studio and he would paint on until his vision was complete or he fell apart exhausted. Anyway, one night it's after midnight and he's out round P. And he hears from the voice. And the voice said, "Move the stones." We didn't know what it meant even. Came again. "Move the stones." This time he's outside someone's front garden. There's a large and curious stone in the garden, and possibly it does require moving. And he scrabbles it up, and once he's got the thing in his arms, it's telling him where it wants to be now. And it was round the corner, and in someone else's garden. And then he's about to go, when he hears from another stone. This is what he's doing now, every night round P. He's moving the stones. Anyway, this evidently is having... it's a great benefit to the mighty canvas. Things were really moving on apace with that. But then one night he's picked up for it by the Polizei of P. Evidently, stone moving wasn't much of a crime. It probably wasn't a crime at all. But it was felt that for Hans's own protection, that he should now turn his talent towards jigsaws. Basket weaving in a supervised environment. Anyway, he was in this place 4 weeks and then he was called up to see the fat important man. The fat important man took a great deal of interest in Hans, his life, his work, his art, his thinking. And eventually the fat important man asked this. He said, "Have you a commission?" And Hans thought there was probably something riding on this, so he said, "Yes." And the fat important man bowed slightly. And he apologised to Hans that Hans had been kept there so long, so needlessly, and he helped Hans pack. And then he waved him and wished him all the best with his commission. Anyway, when Hans got back to his studio, he decided to pack everything up and to leave forever the small town of P and go live in the large city of F. "Have you a commission?" I don't know. When I heard that, "Have you a commission?" I don't know. I found it really quite stirring. I mean, apart from anything else, it's a good tip, isn't it? If you're ever in that circumstance, have you a commission? Yeah, yeah. Anyway, what really does it mean, you know? "Well, have I got a commission?" I mean, it'd be handy if you had one, wouldn't it? Okay. "Well, if I've got a commission, it probably has something to do with that dream. Enormous swimming bath. Vegetation and foliage in it. I mean, try and handle this. Imagine that the Bard of Avon, one night in a dream, he hits on his finest so far. He wakes himself up, he writes down a few things. Next morning he reads, castle, Scandinavia, bloke in tights." See where I've written it there. "Enormous swimming bath, vegetation and foliage in it." I'm often reading this little bit here. "I have spent much time thinking about the alleged pseudo-relations that are called coincidences. What if some of them should not be coincidences?" I think that's a quotation, and I'll look back to find out who'd written that. The answer is an author called Charles thought. He was an American author writing in the 20s and 30s. Apparently he'd written The Crackpot's Golden Bough. He was one of the monstrosities of literature. Apostle of the exceptional, high priest of the improbable. To read Charles Fort is like taking a ride on a comet. He sends you reeling against the doors which open onto something other. Anyway, these guys, Powers and Bergier, they don't actually read the Book of the Damned. But down here in a footnote, they've heard of another one called Lo, as in Lo and Behold, L-O exclamation mark. Apparently that one really was fantastic. Like, well, I don't know. Well, maybe that's the tip here. Maybe I meant to get hold of a copy of Lo. Anyway, so I went to Foyle's. And they were no clean use at all. I was now touring round antique bookstores, you know, the arcane bookshops of London and environs. But it wasn't until I got to Birmingham that I met a man who'd heard of it, and Newcastle-on-Tyne I was when I met a man who reckoned he'd once had one. Well, I'd sort of given up the search, I think. But then I was asked to direct Canadian comedy show, and so I went to Toronto, and I was trying to cast the thing, not finding it easy at all. In fact, I was beginning to think that Canadian comedy show might be a contradiction in terms, like military intelligence. but anyway, one morning in came this guy, Andy Jones. He was a fat Newfoundlander. He had thick glasses, made the eyes look big and bulgy like a frog's. And he was funny. But, well, that's all right. We'll build the whole show around Andy Jones. And that afternoon, I was in the W.H. Smiths of Toronto. And I'll tell you how it happened. There was up high, there was a book of Red Indian photographs. Photographs taken in the 1880s, sepia prints. But it was a bit too high for me. So I moved this carton over to stand on to reach it. And my foot ripped through the carton, and inside it were complete works of Charles Fort. And I just let the book open where it would. This is what I read. Ladies, if you kiss a frog, and make a regular practice of this, and morning and evening was the recommended regimen here, and if a frog starts to look a bit dicky, you must choose the most robust of its tadpoles and get kissing that. And if you feel it may be soon that you're going to be departing this vale of tears, you must pass the practice on to your daughter. And so it must go on through the generations, through the centuries. But eventually, says Fort, you will come up with a prince. His pseudo-proof of this is a cup of tea. It is not the tea at the edge. Is not that a wee bit more cuppish than the stuff in the middle? Is not the interior rim of the cup not a load more tish than the outside of the cup, the handle for it? I was damn right, I thought, yeah. So I bought the book. Right, there was something odd about it. I didn't open the book anymore. I just put it in my case, and then it was in my case when I came back to London, and then I took it out of the case, and no, I didn't open it anymore. And I put it pride of place on the bookshelf. I did something else. I also brought back Andy Jones, because I thought people might like to laugh at him over here. I'll tell you something weird. I've combed through this many times, and that bit about kissing frogs isn't in it. This is what I was reading. I was in chapter 16 of Lo. He walked around the horses. Upon November the 25th, 1809, Benjamin Bathurst returned from Vienna, where at the court of the Emperor Francis he had been representing the British government, was in the small town of Perlberg, Germany. In the presence of his valet and his secretary, Benjamin Bathurst was examining horses which were to carry his coach over more of his journey back to England. Under observation, he walked around to the other side of the horses. He vanished. For details, see the Cornhill magazine. Pages 55 to 279. He vanished, a bomb. Noise from behind me, a book had fallen out of the bookshelf. And Maybe the waiter cleaned that one out and upset it or something. It was Joseph Conrad's Chance. Who's that? Not really. A little thumbnail there. She has chosen to disappear. That's all. But there was that night a strange silence. You know, one might say a devouring silence. It was as if the silence itself was eating all the creaks and the bumps and the ticks which are proper to the night. And in this silence, I couldn't help it, but my mind kept replaying and replaying what seemed to me to be a significant event of that night. What was that bit? What was that bit? He went for an ice cream in the interval. I say, it vanishes. And then after perhaps something else, boom, Bathurst vanishing. The only thing I can think is that there must be some sort of non-physical entity, a fairy, if you will, and her special subject is enchanted vanishment. And she was so thrilled that I was going to be writing on her subject that night, she'd given me this helpful little kick into the arena. And I found myself asking myself this. I said, well then, Ken, do you think then that sometimes people do just vanish? And I said, yes. It's when you're as clear as this about it, you go. It's maybe a worse thought, yeah. It's when you think you're as clear as this about it, you think you've gone. Oh, you know, then the horror of being found 3 days later by caring neighbours like some thing in the bed. I've been thinking about other things now. I think about holidays, where I might go on holiday. That's I don't know, there was a demand on me. There was a demand that I should contemplate vanishment. The following morning I rose late. I couldn't find any clothes which suited my mood, so I put none on. And I devoted the morning to bizarre experimentation, like seeing actually how long you could take to make a cup of coffee. And I tried to read my mail without opening the envelope. But it would be about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was at work, and I'd taken with me into the toilet a complete works of thought. And I read on into chapter 16. It carries on like that. You know, he walked around the horses. Little sentences like, he went for an ice cream in the interval. The last thing known before somebody disappears, teleports off. He ran into a mill. A young man employed in the Augusta Mills has disappeared. He was seated in the company's office when he arose and ran into the mill. He has not been seen since. The mill has been almost taken to pieces by the searchers and the river, woods and country have been scoured, but to no avail. Nobody saw him leave town, nor was any reason for his doing so. Then on into the next chapter, chapter 17. God, this is odd. This is like the other end of disappearance. Bizarre arrivals. Naked in the street. Strange conduct by a strange man. Early in the evening of January the 6th, weather bitterly cold, a naked man appeared from nowhere that could be found out in High Street, Chatham. This naked man of Chatham appeared suddenly. Nobody had seen him on his way to his appearing point. His clothes were searched for but could not be found. Nowhere near Chatham was anybody reported missing. I have records of six persons who between January the 14th, 1920, December the 9th, 1923, were found wandering in or near the small town of Romford, Essex, England, unable to tell how they got there or anything else about themselves. I've come upon many cases like that of a man who told that he was walking along Euston Road, London, and but 9 months later, when next he was aware of where he was, found himself working on a farm in Australia. And it goes on into a bizarre arrival of objects and apport of things. Oh, Lord, when I was reading that, I was thinking, you know, it had only been 3 weeks before, the saga of the keys. It was like this, it was about 7:30, I thought, I think I'll go to the pub now. And, I hadn't got my keys. But that's all right, they weren't in my pocket, they'd be in the kitchen drawer. Went in the kitchen drawer, they weren't in my pocket, and they weren't on the hook. And they weren't by the bed. Now looking in other pairs of trousers. If I was looking in pairs of trousers I didn't even recognise, and they were now looking in jackets, you know. Maybe I've started putting my keys in jackets, I don't know. Like that. And finally I was in front of the kitchen drawer. I said, fucking keys be in there! Thank you very much, my God. I'd like to know how low begins. A naked man in a city street. The track of a horse in volcanic mud. The mystery of reindeer's ears. A huge black form like a whale in the sky, and it drips red drops as if attacked by celestial swordfishes. An appalling cherub appears in the sea. Confusions. Showers of frogs, blizzards of snails, gushes of periwinkles down from the sky. And why, if I'm going to tell of hundreds of these, is the quite ordinary so regarded? Listen, everything I've been reading you there is punctuated by hyphens. In fact, damn near the whole of "no" is punctuated by hyphens. And somewhere or another, Fawkes tells us why. It's his opinion that everything in the universe is linked with everything else. Therefore, a full stop is a lie. Or a hyphen coming straight at you. An unclothed man shocks a crowd. A moment later, if nobody is generous with an overcoat, somebody is collecting handkerchiefs to knot around him. A naked fact startles a meeting of a scientific society, and whatever it has loins is soon diapered with conventional explanations. An onion, a lump of ice, and what have they in common? I thought, this is no regular way to write a book, is it? And then it came to me what this is. This is incantation. And at that moment, there was a knock at the door. I decided to answer it. I had to put the dog blanket round me. And there were two actors there, Mark Wilde and David Stockton. And their first words were, "Andy Jones has disappeared." I mean, really weird what's going on. I said, "I'll tell you what is the best thing, what I'd like you to do." And I gave them each a piece of paper and a pen. I said, "What I want you to do is to write down on those pieces of paper exactly what you mean by that remark, Andy Jones has disappeared." And no conferring, okay? And then I collected it up, and both the accounts tallied. It was like this, evidently. You see, they've been rehearsing pub hours in the Falcon with Andy Jones, these sketches that I'd written for the Andy Jones comedy tour of Britain. Anyway, pub hours, and so they've been slung out at 3:20. And once out, Andy Jones said he had to go to the toilet. And so he'd gone down the public convenience. Mark and David hung around at the top, waiting for him. And they'd waited a long time. And they decided to go down and hurry him up. But when they got down there, there was no one there. I said, "Boys," I said, "this is so odd," I said. "It's like something is trying to teach me something." I said, "as if I've been enrolled in the Phantom Academy or something." And I told them about the visit I'd had that night before of the fairy. Anyway, Mark said, "Well, I think we should go to the police." I said, yeah, I mean, it was a dilemma. Now, I mean, I could see even maybe if we went to the police, yeah, maybe they'd help find Andy Jones. But on the other hand, I felt a bit rushing off to the cops at this moment. I'd get crossed off the register of the Invisible College or whatever it was. And so I said, "Well, yeah." I said, "I'll tell you what." No, I said, "Look, before we go to the police, let's just call the prophet in." Anyway, they agreed to that. The prophet was a remarkable guy who was living up the road. He styled himself a protean synthesist, and here's how he thought about himself. I would say, you know those Hindu gods and goddesses that have, the X-ram coming out the elbow and shoulder and whatnot. Well, if you ask the prophet a question, it was as if, with his many arms, he would be rooting through remote and remarkable libraries of world culture. I mean, he would be speed-reading locked grimoires on your behalf. Anyway, the prophet always give you an answer like no one else could. Anyway, he agreed to come over. And then when I heard his knock at the door, I raced to answer it. I tell you why, because I wanted a test that he was actually the right man for this rather big job. I said, prophet, Andy Jones has disappeared, and we think it's a round the horses job. Reaching in. And then he turned to me and he said, "Benjamin Bathurst?" Yeah. Right. I said, "No, no." We told Robert all the bizarre details of the mystery, you see. And Mark said, "What's going on?" And the prophet said, boys, he said, do you listen to nothing that I tell you? He said, the true nature of the universe is unknown and unknowable. He said, your problem here is that your world reality picture is based on half-ingested science. He said, these so-called scientific laws, he said, they're not laws at all. They weren't given to a bearded gent on a mountain top. He said, they're mere observation on how it usually goes. He said, there is only one word in the English language which approximates the true nature of the universe. And that word is other. And every little once in a long while, the other will manifest. He said, and it is good to be around at those times, because if you've the courage, there may be something up for grabs. Mark said, I think we should go to the police. Mark said, yes, he said, we could go to the police. He said, but he said, what actually have we got for the police, which they can base their inquiries? He said, presumably it'll be our duty to call attention to Kenneth's visit from the library angel. He said, also to the bizarre synchronicity that Kenneth is in his lab reading what he holds to be incantatory literature when Andy Jones is teleported out of his toilet. I mean, really, we've not got anything else to give the police on which they can base their inquiries. He said, and if we race in there telling them these things, he said, I think we'll be all right. I don't think we'll be arrested. He said, but I'm fucking sure we'll be put on a list. Well, Mark said, well, come on, he said, let's go and look for him. Prophet said, yes. He said, but statistically, in cases of bizarre removal, one is quicker to be united with the victim if one just goes severely about one's business. Then if what happens is what we all hope happens, that Andy Jones is returned to flesh form in the Camden Town area, he'll have something to return to. He said, if you weren't here, what would you be doing? And they said, well, we might be doing anything at the moment, but in half an hour we'd be rehearsing again. The prophet said, so go rehearse. And off they went. And when they'd gone, I said to the prophet, I said, look, just tell me, Do you really think that what we've got here is an actual case of round the horses teleportation? He said, no. He said, no. He said, I'll tell you what I think you've got here is a case of invisibility. I said, really? Evidently, invisibility is merely a matter of being able to hide in front of things. I said, how does that work? He said, I've told you about the 14th century Japanese spy Korea monks, haven't I? I don't know, you may have. Well, apparently there'd been an article in a recent Lancet which somewhat vindicated the early work by the 14th century Nip monks in this field. Evidently, experiments had been done on the eyeballs of newly hatched ducklings, and the muscles of their tiny eyeballs had responded to the shape of predatory birds flying overhead, but they responded in no way to the shape of starlings, pigeons, or concord. And as it is with the ducklings, so it is with us, said the prophet. From the moment we are hatched from our mother's womb, the muscles of our eyeballs are ready from that very first moment to respond to the shape which threatens. Thus, if you can train yourself to progress yourself in a series of bizarrely unalarming postures, you can bypass the muscles of the human eye. He waved goodbye with his many arms. But I don't know. You see, I think that the great man there may be explaining one miracle with two. I mean, isn't it this way? Look, let's pick up Andy Jones now. He's down in that public convenience. He's sort of finished now. And he's coming up the stairs. Presumably he's adjusting his dress in some way. Happens to hit one of these bizarrely unalarming postures. That's bypassing the muscles of the eyeballs of Mark and David. But they must have been hanging around themselves in bizarrely unalarming postures to bypass the other. There he goes. Well, there you are. Now, I always like to give the audience the benefit of the prophet's explanation, because I know it does give comfort to some. Now, I'll tell you this, though. If you feel you may have been responsible for the teleportation of a treasured charm, it gives you pause.
Ken Campbell, The Seekers podcast, was produced and presented by Daisy Campbell and David Bramwell, with kind permission from the Ken Campbell estate. Music was by Horton Jupiter. It was funded by Arts Council England. The disembodied voice of Ken was Jeremy Stockwell. Ken Campbell interview with kind permission of Sheridan Thayer.